You're listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a set of essays by Rudolf Steiner that were introductions to Goethe's scientific writings. It's entitled Nature's Open Secret. This is chapter 11, entitled Goethe's Way of Thinking Compared to Other Views. The theories of earlier thinkers, or of those contemporaries who influenced Goethe's intellectual development, did not serve as the basis for his views. Goethe's form and manner of thinking, and indeed the very way he viewed the world, were shaped by his inherent disposition. This was true from his earliest youth and remained so throughout his life. Two of Goethe's main characteristics deserve notice here. One is his thirst for the wellspring and depths of all existence. In the final analysis, it was his faith in the idea. Goethe was always filled with an inkling of something higher and better. One might call it a deeply religious side of his character. What so many find necessary was foreign to him, the urge to pull things down to their own level, to strip them of anything sacred. He had another need, to sense something higher and to work his way up toward it. In everything, he looked for some aspect he could revere. Carl Julius Schroer demonstrated this in a charming way in regard to Goethe's love life. Goethe cast out all that was frivolous or superficial, and for him love became a form of devotion. He expressed beautifully this fundamental quality of his being in his own words, quote, "In our bosom surges a pure longing to give ourselves freely in gratitude to something higher, purer, unknown. We call it devotion." From Trilogy of Passion, Elegy. End of quote. This side of Goethe's being is inseparably connected with another. He never attempts to approach that higher presence directly, but instead through nature. Quote, "The true is like the divine. It never appears directly. We must intuit it through its manifestations." Close quote from Verses in Prose. In addition to his faith in the idea, Goethe believed that we attain the idea by observing outer reality. It never occurred to him to look for the divine anywhere but in the works of nature, where he always attempted to find the divine element. Even as a young boy, Goethe erected an altar to the great God, quote, "Directly connected with nature," close quote from Poetry and Truth, Part 1, Book 1. That ritual arose from the belief that the highest we can reach may be attained by faithfully cultivating our relationship with nature. Thus, what we have elaborated as a theory of knowledge was Goethe's inherent mode of observation. He approached reality with the conviction that all things are manifestations of the idea, which we attain only by raising our sensory experience to spiritual contemplation. This conviction began in childhood and remained a part of him. It became his fundamental assumption. No philosopher could have given Goethe such a conviction. He was not looking to them for that, but for something else. His way of observing was anchored in the depths of his being, but he needed a language with which to formulate it. His nature worked in a philosophical way and expressed itself in philosophical formula, which could be explained only on philosophical premises. And he looked to the philosophers to become fully aware of what he was, to realize the activity living in him. He looked to them to explain and justify his own being. To that end, he studied Spinoza and discussed science with the philosophers of his time. In Goethe's youth, Spinoza, 1632 to 1677, and Giordano Bruno, 1548 to 1600, seemed to express his inner being most strongly. It is remarkable that in both cases, he first encountered their works through attacks against them, yet nevertheless recognized that their teachings related to his own nature. This is especially true of Giordano Bruno's teachings. He encountered Bruno in Bale's titled Dictionary of History and Criticism, in which Bruno is violently attacked. This affected Goethe to the degree that in the parts of Faust conceived around 1770, when he was reading Bale, we find verbal echoes of Bruno's sentences. In his diaries and notebooks, Tag und Jahresheften, the poet tells us that in 1812 he returned to Bruno. This time the impression was even more profound, and many of the poems he wrote that year echo the philosopher from Nola. This is not to say that Goethe borrowed or learned anything specific from Bruno. Rather, he found in his writings a way to formulate what had always lived within his own nature. He found that he could express himself most clearly when he used Bruno's words. Bruno considered universal reason to be, quote, the creator and guide of the universe, close quote. He called reason the inner artist that forms matter, materia, from the inside outward. Reason gives rise to all that exists, and there is no being in which reason will not lovingly participate. Bruno said that, quote, no matter how small and fragile a thing may be, it contains a part of the spiritual substance, close quote. Footnote: see Cause, Principle, and Unity, Essays on Magic, New York, Cambridge University Press, 1999, editor, end of footnote. This coincided with Goethe's view that we cannot judge a thing properly unless we can see the way universal reason has placed it just where it is and how it has become what we encounter. Sensory perception is not enough, because our senses fail to explain how the thing relates to the universal idea in terms of its meaning for the larger whole. We must therefore observe in such a way that our reason builds an ideal foundation upon which to see what the senses communicate. As Goethe put it, we must, quote, look with the eyes of the spirit, close quote. Here, too, he borrowed a formula from Bruno. Quote, we use different sensory organs to recognize colors and sounds. Similarly, we do not use the same eyes to see the substrate of the arts and that of nature, because we see one with our sensory eyes and the other with our eyes of reason. Close quote. This is also true of Spinoza. His teaching is based on the idea that the divine has fully entered the world. Human beings can hope to know God only by plunging into the world. From a Spinozistic viewpoint, any other way seems impossible, because God has renounced his own existence and cannot be found outside of the world. Rather, we must look for him where he is. Any real knowledge of the world must be such that it delivers us some knowledge of God. All higher insight is therefore a meeting with God. We call it knowledge in beholding. We know things sub specie aeternitatis, as emanations of God. The laws in nature that our mind recognizes are God's being, not just made by God. All that we see as logical necessity is thus because God's being, or eternal lawfulness, is inherent in it. This view struck a chord in Goethe. He firmly believed that nature in all its activity reveals the divine. And here this belief was expressed in the clearest way. Quote, I am holding fast, and increasingly so, to the atheists, Spinoza's, veneration of God. Close quote. Goethe wrote to Friedrich Jacobi, who at that point was trying to show Spinoza in a different light. Herein lies the kinship between Spinoza and Goethe. This deep inner harmony between Goethe's being and Spinoza's teaching is often overlooked by those who emphasize a superficial reason for Goethe's attraction to Spinoza, that is, that neither could tolerate an explanation of the world through ultimate causes. In fact, this rejection by both Goethe and Spinoza was a result of even more fundamental views. Let us consider the theory of final causes, teleology, the way it explains the existence and characteristics of something is to establish its usefulness to another thing. One shows that a thing is constituted in a certain way because of the particular characteristics of something else. This assumes that a world creator exists above the two things and makes them so that each meets the needs of the other. If the creator lives within all things, however, this explanation makes no sense, because then the properties of a thing must follow from the active principle within it. We look into the nature of a thing for the reason it is one way and not another. If we believe that the divine lives within each thing, it will never occur to us to look for an external principle to explain its lawfulness. Goethe's relationship with Spinoza needs no explanation other than the fact that he found in his work the formulas and scientific language to express his own inner world. If we now consider Goethe's relationship with his contemporaries, we must speak primarily of Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, who is generally considered the founder of modern philosophy. In his own time, he created such a stir that every well-educated person was required to come to terms with him. This intellectual encounter became necessary for Goethe as well. But for him it proved unfruitful, because there is a deep contradiction between Kant's theories and what we may speak of as Goethe's way of thinking. Indeed, we can say without hesitation that all of German thinking runs along two parallel lines, one permeated by Kant's way of thinking, and the other closer to Goethe's thinking. But as contemporary philosophy continues to approach that of Kant, it moves further from Goethe. Thus it is becoming less and less possible to understand and appreciate Goethe's worldview. We shall describe here the main points of Kant's philosophy to the extent that they are relevant to Goethe's views. According to Kant, the point of departure for human thinking is experience, the world as revealed to the senses, including what our inner sense conveys in the way of psychological and historical facts, and so on. The world consists of a multiplicity of things in space and processes in time. It is a matter of indifference that a particular object faces me or that I experience this particular process. It could have been something else completely. In fact, I can even eliminate, in thought, the whole multitude of things and processes. I cannot, however, imagine the world without space and time. For me, there can be nothing that is neither spatial nor temporal. Even if such things exist, I cannot know it, because I cannot picture anything without space and time. I know only that for me this is the form in which I must encounter things. Space and time, therefore, are the conditions of my sensory perceptions. I know nothing of things as such. I know only how they must appear to me, if they are to exist for me at all. With this, Kant introduces a new problem. He introduces a new kind of question into science. Earlier philosophers had wanted to know the properties of things, but he wants to know how a thing must appear to become the object of our knowledge. Philosophy for Kant is the science of the conditions under which human experience of the world becomes possible. We know nothing about, in quotes, the thing in itself. But our task is not fulfilled when we merely perceive a multitude of objects in time and space. We try to create unity in that multiplicity, and that is the task of the intellect, which is the sum of those activities whose purpose is to organize the sensory world that confronts us into pre-arranged forms. the intellect connects two sensory perceptions by establishing one, for example, as a cause, the other as an effect, or one as the substance and the other as a property. Again, the task of philosophical science is to show under which conditions the intellect succeeds in creating a system of the world. So the world is, in the Kantian sense, a subjective manifestation that arises in the forms of the sensory world and the intellect. All I can know for sure is that there is a thing in itself. Its appearance depends on our organization. Obviously, it makes no sense to assume that this sensory world, formed by the intellect, has any significance other than for our own cognitive capacity. This becomes clearest when Kant speaks of the meaning of the world of ideas. According to him, ideas are simply higher vantage points of reason, under which the lower entities created by our intellect can be subsumed. Our intellect, for example, establishes connections among psychological manifestations. Reason, our capacity for ideas, then grasps these connections as though they all emanated from a soul. But this has no significance for the actual reality itself. It is merely a means of orientation for our cognitive capacity. This is Kant's theoretical philosophy, inasmuch as we are interested in it here. The polarity between it and Goethe's philosophy is obvious. According to Kant, we determine given reality. It is the way it is because we conceive it that way. Kant actually skips over the real epistemological question. At the beginning of his title, Critique of Pure Reason, he takes two steps that he doesn't justify, and his whole philosophical edifice suffers as a result. He simply distinguishes between subject and object without investigating the significance of the fact that our intellect makes such a distinction between two realms of reality, in this case the knowing subject and the object to be known. He then attempts to formulate conceptually the mutual relationship between these two domains, again without inquiring into the meaning of such a formulation. If Kant hadn't viewed the central epistemological question from a skewed perspective, he would have noticed that the distinction between subject and object is only an intermediate step in the process of cognition, that underlying them both is a unity perceptible by reason, and that the qualities we ascribe to a thing are not merely subjective. A thing is a unity constituted by reason, and it is the intellect that distinguishes between the, in quotes, thing in itself and the, in quotes, thing according to us. It is simply inadmissible to say that what we attribute to the thing in one case can be denied it in another. Whether I see the same thing from one point of view or from another, it, nevertheless, remains a unified whole. An error that permeates Kant's philosophical edifice is his belief that the multiplicity of the sense-perceptible world is something fixed, and that science constitutes the systematization of that multiplicity. He never realized that this multiplicity is not something ultimate that we must overcome if we are to understand it. Consequently, according to Kant, all theory is merely added onto experience by our reason and intellect. The idea, for him, is not what reason recognizes as the deeper ground of the given world after penetrating the multiplicity on the surface. Rather, to him the idea is a methodological principle that makes it easier to organize phenomena. According to Kant, we would go astray if we were to believe it possible to conceptually derive things from the idea. We can organize our experiences only as though they all arose from a unity. Footnote: The distinction between the Goethean and Kantian concepts of unity is well articulated by Henri Bortoft in title The Wholeness of Nature. Editor and a footnote. According to Kant, we have no concept of the foundation of things as they exist in themselves. Our knowledge of things is present only for our sake, is valid only for our individuality. Goethe was unable to gain much from this worldview. In his view, our observation of things in terms of ourselves always plays a subordinate role that involves responses of pleasure and displeasure. He expected science to do more than tell us how things are in relation to ourselves. In his essay, quote, entitled The Experiment as Mediator Between Subject and Object, he describes the task of researchers. They are not to impose their own standards and criteria, but to take them from within the sphere of the things observed. This one sentence is enough to show how very different the Kantian way of thinking is from that of Goethe. Kant considered all judgments about things to be merely the product of subject and object, telling us only how the subject sees the object. According to Goethe, on the other hand, the subject selflessly enters into the object, taking the criteria for judgment from the context of the things themselves. Goethe himself said of Kant's students that, quote, they could indeed hear me, but could not respond, nor could they be of any help, close quote. The poet felt he had gained much more from Kant's titled Critique of Judgment, and see page 88 in this book. Goethe had a more philosophically rewarding relationship to Schiller. Through Schiller, Goethe's insight into his own way of seeing progressed a step further. Until his well-known conversation with Schiller, Goethe had established a certain way of looking at the world. He observed plants and established an archetypal plant from which individual forms could be derived. The archetypal plant, and likewise a corresponding archetypal animal, took form in his mind and served to explain related phenomena. But he had never thought about what the essential nature of the archetypal plant might be. Schiller opened his eyes by calling it an idea. After that, Goethe was aware of his idealism. Until then, he had called it the archetypal plant. He had called the archetypal plant an experience, because he believed that he saw it with his eyes. In the introduction written later for his essay, The Metamorphosis of Plants, titled, Goethe says that, quote, thus I endeavored to find the archetypal animal, which means ultimately the idea of the animal, close quote. Nevertheless, we must bear in mind that Schiller did not convey to Goethe something foreign to him. Rather, it was only by observing Goethe's way of knowing that Schiller found his way to an objective idealism. Schiller contributed only the terminology to describe the way of knowing that he recognized and admired in Goethe. Goethe received little from Fichte, whose realm was too far removed from Goethe's to have any real effect. Fichte had established a science of consciousness in the most brilliant way, whereby he traced the activity through which the human eye, capital, transforms the given world into a thought world. He could have stopped with his description of the human eye as giving a satisfying form to the given and creating relevant connections between disconnected givens. But he made the mistake of believing that this activity is the creation of everything that takes place in the eye. Therefore, his views come through as a one-sided idealism that takes its entire content from consciousness. Goethe, who always looked for the objective, was unable to find much that attracted him in Fichte's philosophy. Goethe had no understanding for what was valid in it, and the poet certainly found fault with the way Fichte expanded it into a universal science. With the young Schelling, who was Fichte's student, there were many more points of contact. He not only proceeded to analyze the activity of the eye, but also studied the activity within consciousness, through which consciousness comprehends nature. Schelling saw the objective reality of nature, its actual principle, as playing itself out in our eye through our cognition of nature. To him, external nature was merely the solidified form of our concepts of nature. What lives in us as an ideal view of nature appears again outside us, only separated out in space and time. What we encounter outside of us as nature is a finished product, the determined, hardened form of a living principle. This principle cannot be attained through external experience, but must be created first in our soul. Schelling says in his title Ideas for a Philosophy of Nature, quote, "To philosophize about nature means to create nature. Nature as a mere product, natura naturata, is what we call nature as object, the concern of all empiricism. Nature as productivity, natura naturans, is what we call nature as subject, the concern of all theory." The contrast between empiricism and science lies in the fact that empiricism views its object as existing, as finished and accomplished, whereas science sees it in a state of becoming and still being brought about. Through these views of Schelling, with which Goethe became acquainted, partly as a result of personally meeting the philosopher, the poet was brought another step forward. Now, he came to see that his tendency was to progress from the finished product to what is in a state of becoming or being produced. We hear this resonance with Schelling in his essay titled Judgment Through Intuitive Perception, where he writes that, quote, "by observing an ever-increasing nature," close quote, he endeavored to make himself, quote, "worthy of spiritual participation in her productions," close quote. Finally, Hegel helped Goethe to become clear about the place of the archetypal phenomenon from a philosophical point of view. Hegel deeply understood the meaning of the archetypal phenomenon and characterized it in his letter of February 20, 1821, quote, "You place the simple and abstract at the top, and you aptly call it the archetypal phenomenon. You then show how concrete phenomena result from the effects of further influences and conditions. And finally, you organize the whole process so that the series proceeds from the simple conditions to the more complex. And as a result of this ranking and gradual elaboration, the complex appears in full clarity." To track down the archetypal phenomenon, to free it from other accidental surrounding conditions, and to apprehend it in the abstract, in quotes, as we say, "to me this is the accomplishment of a great and spiritual understanding of nature, and I am convinced that it represents the truly scientific aspect of knowledge in this field. May I also mention to you the special interest we philosophers take in this archetypal phenomenon that is raised for our view. We can certainly make use of such a distillate. We have our absolute, initially so oyster-like, gray, or quite black, which we have struggled to bring into the light and air, for which it is now beginning to long. And we need to cut windows to bring it completely into the light of day. Our schemes would vanish into thin air if we introduced them too quickly into the colorful, chaotic company of the world's unpleasantness. It is here that your honor's archetypal phenomena come in handy. In this double light, spiritual and conceptual in its simplicity, visible and palpable in its sensuality, the two worlds meet, our abstruse one and that of manifest existence." Footnote, Steiner may have had this letter in mind when he formulated the, quote, "house analogy," close quote, described on page X of the editor's introduction to this book. And I afraid I didn't read that. End of footnote. And that was close quote. Hegel thus clarified for Goethe the thought that the empirical scientist must go all the way to the archetypal phenomena, and that from there the paths of philosophy lead onward. This makes it clear, however, that the fundamental thought of Hegelian philosophy is a consequence of the Goethean form of thinking. Both Goethe and Hegel considered it fundamental to transcend external reality by penetrating deeply into it, thus rising from the created to the creative, from the determined to what determines. In his philosophy, of course, Hegel only wishes to uncover the eternal process from which all things proceed. He wants to see the given as resulting from what he recognizes as the absolute. Consequently, Goethe's acquaintance with philosophers and philosophical tendencies helped him to understand what was already present in him. He gained nothing new as far as his own views were concerned, but he gained the means to speak of them and say what he was doing and what was taking place within his soul. As a result, Goethe's worldview offers numerous points for further philosophical elaboration. Initially, they were seized only by Hegel's students. The rest of philosophy remained at a polite distance. Only Schopenhauer, who held the poet in high esteem, based some aspects of his own philosophy on Goethe's work. In a later chapter, we will speak of Schopenhauer's praise for the color theory. Here we will confine ourselves to the more general relationship between Schopenhauer's ideas and Goethe's. He comes close to Goethe in one point. He rejects any attempt to derive the given phenomena from external causes, and recognizes only the activity of an inner lawfulness, only a step-by-step process from one appearance to the next. This is reminiscent of Goethe's principle of finding the elements of an explanation within the things themselves. But this resemblance is deceptive. Schopenhauer wants us to remain in the phenomenal realm because we are unable to attain the, in quotes, thing in itself, which is external to it and beyond our reach, since all phenomena as given to us are really mental representations, and those representations can never take us beyond our own consciousness. Goethe, on the other hand, wants to remain with the phenomena because he actually expects to find the elements that explain them in the phenomena themselves. Finally, we will compare Goethe's worldview with that of Eduard von Hartmann, 1842-1906, whose scientific views are the most important of our time. This writer's title, Philosophy of the Unconscious, has great historical significance. Later writings elaborated what was only outlined in that first book and added new material on a number of points. This work, taken in its entirety, reflects the whole spiritual nature of our time. Hartmann distinguishes himself through his admirable depth of mind and his remarkable mastery of the various sciences. He is on the cutting edge of contemporary intellectual achievement. One need not agree with him to fully appreciate his stature. The reader who knows only the title Philosophy of the Unconscious may be unable to see how close the views of Hartmann and Goethe are to each other. The point where they meet is visible only in Hartmann's conclusions drawn from his principles, which he developed later. Conclusions is italicized, so it might be the name, title of a book or essay by Hartmann. End of aside. Hartmann's philosophy is idealism. He wants to be more than an idealist, but whenever his explanation of the world calls for something absolute, he resorts to ideas. Most important, he thinks of the idea as the fundamental reality underlying all things. His assumption of an unconscious is based on the fact that not every idea in our consciousness is necessarily tied to its conscious form. Ideas are not present, active, only where they are conscious, but in other forms as well. Ideas are more than subjective phenomena. They are significant in and of themselves. Far from being present only in the subject, ideas are objective world principles. When Hartmann includes the will along with ideas as a world-forming principle, it is nevertheless difficult to understand those who view him as just another follower of Schopenhauer, who carried to the extreme the belief that all concepts are merely subjective manifestations of consciousness. With him, it is out of the question that the idea might have participated as a real principle in the constitution of the world. In Schopenhauer's view, the will is exclusively the ground of the world. This is why Schopenhauer never managed to develop the various specialized sciences in relation to his philosophy, whereas Hartmann followed his principle into every scientific domain. Schopenhauer said nothing about history's richness, except that it is a manifestation of the will. Hartmann, on the other hand, finds ideas at the core of every historical phenomenon, which he incorporates into the larger process of human evolution. Schopenhauer is uninterested in individual beings or phenomena, because the only important thing he has to say about them is that they are expressions of the will. Hartmann takes hold of each particular and shows how the idea can be found everywhere. The essential characteristic of Schopenhauer's worldview is uniformity, and that of Hartmann's is unity. Schopenhauer views the world as driven by an empty, uniform impulse. Hartmann sees the world driven by the rich content of the idea. Schopenhauer posits an abstract unity. Hartmann posits the concrete idea as a principle, of which unity, or rather self-consistency, is only one characteristic. Schopenhauer could never have created a philosophy of history, a science of religion, as Hartmann did. Hartmann says, quote, "Reason is the formal, logical principle of the idea, inseparably united with the will, and as such controls and determines the world process without exception." Close quote. This allows him to look for the logical core that can be grasped by our thinking, if not by our senses, in every manifestation of nature and history. Only those who accept this premise will be able to justify their desire to understand the world through thinking, in terms of ideas. Hartmann's objective idealism stands entirely on the foundation of Goethe's worldview. Goethe says, quote, "Everything we become conscious of, and everything we can speak of, is simply a manifestation of the idea," close quote from Verses in Prose. And he demands that people develop their capacity for knowledge to the degree that ideas become visible to them, as visible as the external world is to the senses. Thus, he stands on the ground where ideas are not merely manifestations of consciousness, but objective world principles. The world is formed objectively by what lights up in our thinking like flashes of lightning. The important thing about an idea is not what it means for us consciously, but what it is in itself. It is an underlying principle of the world through its own being. Consequently, thinking is becoming aware of what exists in and of itself. Although the idea could not appear without consciousness, it must nevertheless be understood in such a way that its primary characteristic is not its appearance in consciousness, but what it is in itself, in terms of its intrinsic nature, to which our awareness of it contributes nothing. Following Hartmann, therefore, we must see the idea, aside from its manifestation in consciousness, as the active unconscious underlying the world. It is Hartmann's essential contribution that we must look for the idea in all that is unconscious. But to distinguish what is conscious from what is unconscious is not enough. This distinction is significant only for my consciousness. But we must pursue the idea in its objectivity and fullness. And we must recognize not only that the idea is effective, but also what the nature of that effective agent is. If Hartmann had been content to assert that the idea is unconscious, and if he had then explained the world in terms of this unconscious, which is only one attribute of the idea, then he would have merely added another unified theory to the many that explain the world on the basis of an abstract formula. In fact, his main work was not entirely free of this. But Hartmann's thinking is too concentrated, far-reaching, and deep not to have seen that a definition of the idea as unconscious is inadequate. We must instead penetrate more deeply into what we recognize as unconscious. We must go beyond this characteristic and determine its concrete content, and from it derive its particular manifestations. In this way, Hartmann evolved from an abstract monist, which he still was in his title, Philosophy of the Unconscious, into a concrete monist. It is the concrete idea that Goethe addresses in its three forms, archetypal phenomenon, the type, and the, quote, idea in the stricter sense, close quote. The aspect of Goethe's worldview that we find in Hartmann's philosophy is our becoming aware of the objective nature of the world of ideas and our devotion to it in response to that awareness. It was Hartmann's philosophy of the unconscious that motivated him to pursue the objective idea. Once he recognized that the essence of the idea is not based on its consciousness, he should also have acknowledged the idea as something that exists for itself as an objective reality. He differs from Goethe in that next to the idea, he also sees the will as a formative principle in the world. But this motif of the will has no bearing on the truly fruitful aspect of Hartmann's philosophy. His assumption concerning the will arises from his notion that the idea rests in itself and must be prompted by the will to become active. According to Hartmann, the will alone can never be creative because it is an empty, blind drive toward existence. Before the will can bring something into existence, the idea must come into play because only it can provide its content. But what should we do with this will? It escapes us the moment we try to grasp it, because it is impossible to get hold of an empty, meaningless impulse. Consequently, the idea is the only thing we can grasp as world principle. Only what is filled with content and meaning can be grasped, not something void of meaning. To get hold of the concept of will, it must appear as ideal meaning. Only with and through the idea can it appear, never alone. Whatever exists must have content. All existence must be filled. It cannot be empty. This is why Goethe conceived of idea as active, effective, and not requiring further impetus. Something that is full of meaning cannot receive the impetus to manifest from something that contains no meaning. Consequently, the idea, in Goethe's sense, should be understood as entelechy, that is, as active being. And we must first abstract it from its active form to reintroduce it as will. The idea of pure will is meaningless for empirical science as well. Hartmann does not use it when he deals with concrete phenomena. Hartmann's closeness to Goethe is even more noticeable in his ethics. Edward Hartmann finds that all striving for happiness, all the pursuits of egoism, are ethically worthless, since they cannot lead to satisfaction. To act out of egoism, according to Hartmann, is to act out of an illusion. We should take hold of the task assigned to us by the world and work selflessly for its sake alone. Our goal should be to devote ourselves to the object without attempting to gain anything for ourselves. This is also the fundamental characteristic of Goethe's ethics. Hartmann should not have suppressed the word that expresses the character of his moral theory, love. Footnote, we do not claim that Hartmann does not consider the concept of love in his ethics. He has dealt with it from the phenomenal and metaphysical point of view. But he does not consider love to be the ultimate goal in ethics. self-sacrificing, loving devotion to the world process does not appear to Hartmann to be an end in itself, but only a means of deliverance from the troubles of existence and of regaining our lost state of blissful peace. Rudolf Steiner, end of footnote. When we make no personal claims, when our actions are motivated only by the objective task, when we find the motive of our doing in the act itself, our actions are moral. Then, however, we are acting out of love. All selfishness, everything that is merely personal, disappears. It is characteristic of Hartmann's sound, powerful mind, that though he grasped the idea in a one-sided way in its unconscious form, he nevertheless found his way to concrete idealism, and that though he began with an ethics of pessimism, this distorted point of view led him to the morality of love. Hartmann's pessimism, however, is different from that promulgated by those who like to complain about the uselessness of our actions only to excuse their own passivity. Hartmann does not indulge in complaint, but rises above any such affectation to pure morality. He shows the pursuit of happiness is worthless by revealing its fruitlessness. In this way, he points to the importance of our activity itself. That he is a pessimist at all is his own error, which may also be a remnant of earlier stages in his thinking. But from where he stands now, he should see that one cannot base pessimism on an empirical proof that dissatisfaction predominates in the real world. What is highest in us seeks happiness in its own activity. Let me read that again. What is highest in us cannot want anything other than to create its own happiness. It does not want to receive it as a gift from outside. What is highest in us seeks happiness in its own activity. Hartmann's pessimism dissolves in the light of his own higher thinking. Because the world leaves us dissatisfied, we create the most beautiful happiness for ourselves through our own activity. Hartmann's philosophy provides one more proof that it is possible to reach the same place from different points of departure. His premises were different from those of Goethe, but in their elaboration we encounter Goethe's train of thought at every turn. We have depicted this here to show the deep inner integrity of the Goethean worldview. It is so deeply rooted in the being of the world that we are certain to encounter its main features wherever energetic thinking penetrates through to the sources of knowledge. In Goethe everything was so original, and not at all merely the fashionable view of his time, that even his opponents were bound to think like him. The eternal mystery of the world reveals itself through individuals, and in the modern age it spoke most meaningfully through Goethe. One can indeed say that the significance of a person's views today can be measured by their relationship to Goethe's worldview. The end of chapter 11.